And this is the World War II Oral History Project for History 325, Dr. Tom Rust. And the interviewee is Jim Putnam, a veteran of World War II. And Mr. Putnam, I'd like to ask you some questions based on your service in the war. What was your life like before the war? What was your family's livelihood? Your parents, your brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, that sort of thing?
Well, I had a mother and father and one brother in our family. My dad was a barber. We lived in Mitchell, South Dakota. It's where I was born, in Spencer, South Dakota, 25 miles east. We moved to Mitchell, and that's where I went through school. And that's where I enlisted in the Army Air Corps. Mother took in, of course, I grew up in the dirty 30s, and to make ends meet, because Dad some weeks would only bring home $6 or $7 from barbering. And Mother took in roomers and boarders to help make ends meet. I went through school, started second grade in Mitchell, went through elementary and junior high and high school, and graduated from Mitchell High School in 1939. At that time, the war, of course, Hitler was in march in Europe and had succeeded in capturing France and giving the British all that they could handle. And I didn't think much about the war as long as I was in school. My primary concern was our school and my athletics. I did work part-time after school when I had a chance, primarily at the Red Owl grocery store in Mitchell as backroom boy, cleaning up and sacking coffee and sugar and flour and that sort of thing. Carrying out groceries or candling eggs, whatever was to be done. After I graduated from high school, I received a full-right scholarship to South Dakota State University in Brookings on a track scholarship, but I didn't have the money to pay the incidentals, and neither did my parents. So I took a job with Council Oak Stores in Mitchell. At that time, full-time job paid me $8 a week. When I say full-time, it was from 7 in the morning until 7 at night. Saturdays, we stayed open until 10, and so it was never before midnight before we finished after coming to work at 7 in the morning. After about 2 months there, the manager, Red Owl, came to the back door, and I had worked in high school for him, and so he knew me, and he had an opening at his store, and he offered me a job at $12 a week, and I took my apron off and left and went to work for Red Owl. And that's where I was working when I enlisted into the Army Air Corps in August of 1940. So my family was not involved in politics. My dad had not been in World War I. I did have mother's youngest brother was in World War I. My dad's very best friend in Mitchell was another barber who was in World War I and had been gassed with mustard gas during World War I. I heard some of the war stories from him of World War I. I was not concerned about my welfare or safety at that time. My main concern was to lay enough money aside to take my athletic scholarship at South Dakota State the following year. Then in September of 1930, Hitler invaded Poland. and Congress passed a draft law to become effective in October of 1940. And some of my high school buddies and I decided I was going to take aeronautical engineering at South Dakota State. So we decided to join the Army Air Corps, and as long as we could select our the branch of the military that we wanted, where we joined up. And I have no regrets. I felt very good about enlisting. My mother was a little perturbed about it, but my dad had no qualms about it. From there, I left. I don't know how much more you want me to go on here.
Oh, you can just keep on going.
All right. We left Mitchell. Let's see. I was turned 19 on the 17th of August, and we left Mitchell the next day, and I was sworn in on the 19th of August at Fort Snelling, Minnesota, into the Army Air Corps. I received 1 week of basic training at Fort Snelling, and then we were shipped to Chanute Field, Illinois, at Rantoul, outside of Rantoul in Illinois, to go to airplane and airframe and engines mechanic school there. We received another 2 weeks of basic training, which primarily consisted of marching and drills. We did not have guns, nor were we acquainted with the guns at that time, so I received no military training as far as weapons were concerned, or use of bayonets, or hand-to-hand combat at all. So my basic training was very simple and very easy. We did not have the old drill sergeants in the Air Corps that are portrayed on movies in the theaters today of the rough, tough drill sergeants. I went through airframe and engine mechanic school there and graduated in the spring of 1941, and was assigned to the 60th Transport Group at Middletown Air Depot in Middletown, Pennsylvania. After a 2 week furlough at home, I had to report to Middletown, which I did, and then became acquainted with the squadron that I was assigned to, which was the 12th Transport Squadron at that time. Our Master Chief, the Line Chief, Master Sergeant, had 27 years of military service. We had a corporal in the outfit at that time that had been a corporal for 17 years. But he was not the ranking corporal. There was another corporal that had been corporal for 18 years. So promotions in the old Army came pretty thin and a long ways in between. Then in the early summer of 41, our squadron packed up and moved to Mitchell Field, Long Island, New York. Right outside Hempstead, Long Island, where we stayed, and at which time I took tests, and passed a test to become a specialist in propellers and instruments. And with the specialist rating, I then drew the pay as of a buck sergeant, even though I was still just a private, not even a PFC, not even private first class. And that exempted me from KP, but I did have to pull charge of quarters or CQ duty because of being classed as a non-commissioned officer. We stayed there, in fact, we were there on December 7th, 1941 when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Incidentally, I happened to be CQ, the 12th Transport Squadron, at that time. And at just prior to that, they had changed their name from the 12th Transport Squadron, 60th Transport Group, to the 12th Troop Carrier Squadron, 60th Troop Carrier Group. We had the 11th and the 10th, 11th, and 12th Troop Carrier Squadrons were comprised the 60th Troop Carrier Group. Between December 7th and the first of the year, we made the move from Mitchell Field, Long Island, New York, to Westover Field, Massachusetts, about a 10-mile from Springfield, Massachusetts. We, in February of 1942, we split the group up, and the line chief and assistant line chief, two master sergeants, chose the ones they wanted to go with them. The Master Sergeant Dugan, who was my line chief when I arrived at the squadron in Middletown, picked me along with some of my other friends that I had acquired through the service, one from Minnesota, whose serial number was five numbers behind mine. We stayed together all during school and reassigned to the Troop Carrier Squadron and stayed together through that and went overseas together. So I did have a buddy that I'd known a few years that we did buddy up most of the time while we were gone. Then in the other part of our group went down south and became, I don't remember the name of the group they were in, but it was another troop carrier group, and they wound up in the China-Burma India theater carrying supplies across the hump, the Himalayas were called the hump, and into China. And then we stayed at Westover and until June of 42, at which time our ground crews loaded on boats and were taken across to England. Our air crew stayed behind, and later on, after flying several weeks, supplies up to Goose Bay, Labrador, and into BW-1 and BW-2 in Iceland. Then we all formed together and took off as a group and flew the circle of Greenland to Iceland to Ireland across the water, and that's how we got went across on the first trip from Ireland. Then we went to our base in England. We did have, at one time, we spent a week up in Ireland with the 82nd Airborne on training, and that was the most basic training that I received, because their colonel was a Colonel Rapp, would roll everybody out at 5 in the morning for a 5-mile run, which the paratroopers were used to it, but us Air Corps boys were not. We were there in England about 4 or 5 months. Then from England we took off on the night of November 6th, 1942. And flew from England out around France in the Channel and around Portugal, and then we cut across Spain and went into Algeria, where we dropped paratroopers inside of Oran. Oran was a big coastal port, and one of that the Navy took the Oran coastal port there. We dropped paratroopers 14 miles inland from Oran and secured an air base after 3 days and captured some 800 of the air crews and paratroopers. We captured somewhere around 3,000 Germans and French troops that were at that airport after a three-day skirmish. We lost 5 airplanes on that invasion of North Africa. One of them had engine trouble over Spain and had to land in Spain and were imprisoned there for several months, and finally the U.S. secured their release. They came back to the squadron but were only in the squadron about 10 days before they were sent back to the United States. The major part of our losses was very few loss of life on that. Most of the problems and the loss of planes was some of them were shot down, badly shot up, but we lost one pilot who was shot through the head with a machine gun fire, and the co-pilot brought the plane in safely with the rest of the paratroopers and crew on board. After we secured the air base at Oran, or inside Oran, I believe it was called Taferui, it was the air base. We then gas refueled our airplanes and loaded up with the paratroopers, and we took them up and dropped them again into what would have been the northern part of Tunisia to secure a base up there to attempt to cut off, while they were to secure an air base up there so we Allies would have air cover to harass Rommel, because his supplies were coming on rail from down through Tunisia down into Egypt where he had been headquartered. After that invasion, that was the second one that we did. After that, we flew primarily supply missions, medical evac missions. We carried personnel. At one time, I carried, picked up General Patton at Rabat and took him up to the front where his tanks were at, which was not a happy experience there, but I can look back on it now and think that at least he didn't kick me in the butt like he did some of the other GIs. I also happened to pick up in Marrakech General Ridgway and carried him and his entourage up to Army or Air Corps headquarters at Algiers, in Algeria. Other than that, we flew a lot of missions where we would haul ammunition and landmines and so forth up to the front and come in, go in and land. Even though there was no airfields there, we would land in pasture or whatever we could set down that was not too rough a terrain. We would unload the supplies, set up litters, and haul wounded back. And we could haul 21 wounded in litters on our airplanes. I was aerial engineer, myself and the rest of the crew about 30 minutes to unload and set up the litters, which we carried in storage compartment under the floor. We didn't carry the litters, we had the supports to hold the litters. And the medical people, of course, would load the personnel onto the on litters onto the airplane, and we'd take off and take them back to a general hospital in Algiers primarily. after Rommel was pulled out of and was defeated in Egypt, and he pulled back and got back over to Italy and then on into Germany. Then we started training for our invasion of Sicily. And first we were at a base in North Africa. I do not remember the name of that base. It was not a base, it was just a, out here we'd call it a prairie pasture. Like eastern Montana, it had a lot of short grass to it, so it was, we could just mark out a runway and put up a windsock to get the wind direction and fly out of there. We were stationed out on the Sahara Desert at a place called El Jem, which was in Tunisia. I think it's spelled E-L-J-E-M, I'm not, or G-E-M, I don't remember which. And it was so hot there, we'd go to work at daybreak on the plains, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, the sun was so hot we couldn't stand to touch the airplane, so we would lay off, go to our tents, and soak towels in water and lay on our cots with the wet towels over us to what little breeze would give us some air conditioning, cool our bodies down. And that's how we survived the summer out at El Jem. Then we took off in early September from El Jem and took paratroopers in on the invasion of Sicily one night. And the next night we took gliders, towed gliders in to Sicily also. The gliders landed further inland than the, we dropped the paratroopers pretty much from the coast to a couple of miles inland on various, what was considered strategic locations. The gliders, of course, went in further. After Sicily was secured, we moved to Sicily from Tunisia, and we were stationed again there, and one night we had a torrential rain and our airfield was flooded. The airfield had over a foot of water standing on it. Many of our tents were flooded. We got up on a Sunday morning and sloshed through water to get to higher ground, drag our barracks bags and take and empty them out and hang them on the ground or wherever we could find a bush to dry out. It was over a week before we could even drive a Jeep out to the airplanes. Then we moved down by Catania, Sicily, at the base of Mount, what's that volcano over there?
Is it Etna?
Yeah. And we were spent the winter there, and from there we took paratroopers. That's after we'd made the invasion of Italy. We made the invasion of Italy from El Jem again. The two invasions, first Sicily and then 6 weeks or 2 months later we took paratroopers one night into Italy, and then we took gliders the next night, of which the American Navy shot down. There was 150 airplanes of us, and the American Navy shot down 75 of them. The loss of life was pretty bad, and that was never uncovered and only released for publication several years after World War II. It was a sad day because we lost a lot of good crews and good friends on that trip. Let's take a break.
Okay.
At Gila, Sicily is where we were at when the floods hit. We finally, the field dried out, and we were able to get out to our airplanes. In some cases, they had settled into the mud, and we had to dig out the wheels so we could taxi up out of the holes that they had created. Shortly after that, we moved down to Catania, Sicily, which is close to the volcano there, and I believe which is Mount Etna. And then after the Italy was secured in the southern part of Italy, we moved over to the east coast of Italy at a community or town called Brindisi. And from there we got paratroopers in Greece, and we also supplied the partisans in Greece and Yugoslavia and Albania. Most of those were night missions. We did do some day missions. We'd go in and land in daytime and haul partisan wounded out. In those daylight missions, we usually had fighter escort, which usually was P-38s that would fly cover for us while we were on the ground. I did go in on one mission to repair a Russian C-47 that had landed there in Yugoslavia and damaged their propeller, and they had no parts, so we, the partisans, covered their airplane and hid them out until radio contact was made and we could get, we had a spare propeller. We took it in. I flew over with the crew and two mechanics and myself to change the propeller for the Russians, who were plotting to try and commandeer our own airplane and leave us there with their damaged plane and fly back to Russia. But we thwarted that before the mission could get underway. We did see some very, very inhumane circumstances while we were flying the injured back out of Yugoslavia. One that comes to my mind was a 15-year-old girl that we hauled back on the planes, who had both feet off above the ankle, just above the ankle. Her feet had gotten so badly frostbitten that gangrene set in. We had no medicine or medical facilities available to them. So four men laid across the girl on the ground and put her legs up on a log and took her feet off with an axe and then seared the stub with fire to stop the bleeding. We hauled her back to Italy a day after that, and I'll tell you, that's the gutsiest 15-year-old girl I have ever seen in my entire life. She was landed in Italy and smiling, and after all the ordeal that she had went through, and you can imagine what pain she must have suffered. After the partisans had, and the Germans had pulled out of Yugoslavia, we went in on a daylight mission again with the fighter escort and brought back some 100 bomber crews that had been shot down over the Pulaski oil fields in Poland on their raiding missions, bombing missions, primarily B-24 crews. And we brought them back from this daylight mission back into Italy, and they were very appreciative of the fact. I also flew one night mission over Bucharest, Romania, when it was occupied by the Germans, to just drop leaflets telling the Romanians to hold on, help was coming, that the Allies would soon be there. And that was an unescorted night mission in over Bucharest. We did get some flak, but nothing close to us. We were flying mostly too low for the anti-aircraft guns to get down on us. After our supply missions were ended in Greece and Yugoslavia and Albania, we moved from Brindisi, Italy to Naples, Italy, and we're flying primarily just missions out of there, hauling supplies or whatever was needed. We did a lot of hauling of personnel and dignitaries, Red Cross people at that time that wanted to go into Naples or on into Rome. I happened to have been overseas at that time some over 30 months, and I was sent back to the States on a rest and recuperation furlough, 30-day R&R it was called. I came back by boat in February of 45, and through the North Atlantic in February is not an ideal time. In fact, our troop ship finally broke out the life rafts because we were taking on so much water in 50-foot seas. We did make it back to Norfolk, where we unloaded, and then I was given a 30-day furlough and caught a train and went back to Mitchell. I arrived in Mitchell, my hometown, my parents' house, on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1945, and I came down with another attack of malaria that night. At about 3 in the morning, my fever was so high and I was delirious. My parents called the family doctor, who happened to be an old major in World War I, who came out to the house and recognized malaria. He got the druggist up out of bed and got some quinine for me, and in a week I was able to get up and go out of the house for the first time. In the meantime, he had sent his nurse out the day after his first call to draw blood from me and to confirm that it was malaria, an attempt to keep me from going back overseas. The nurse I had known in high school, she was 2 years younger than I am, and she had in the meantime completed her nursing degree and was then a registered nurse working for the doctor. The first night I was out after I was up and over the malaria, I was downtown and went into one of the favorite drinking spots at the time. And there sat the nurse and her fiancé, and she waved, and they invited me over to the table for drinks. And unbeknownst to me, I just thought it was a date, so I asked her for a date the next day, which would have been Washington's birthday. And so she asked her, I'd say, if that was all right. And he said, "Well, sure." And we dated every night after that until March 30th when we were married. And, you know, they say those war weddings might not last. Well, mine probably didn't. It only lasted 51 and a half years when my wife passed away. So there was one time that a war marriage did last. I did go back overseas by boat in April. The original ship I was scheduled to go back on had been sunk, so I had an extra 30 days at home. And I went back overseas in April, and I was on the ship in the Mediterranean on VE Day when Germany surrendered. And I wound up with my outfit back at Naples, and they were packing up, getting ready to head to South America. And so I got right in and helped them pack. And then we made the move from Naples on the way back to Trinidad, where our 60th Troop Carrier Group was deactivated. And we were transferred to various outfits throughout the Caribbean area. On the way back, one of the airplanes lost an engine. We were landing at a Firestone rubber plantation in Liberia, West Africa. They made it safely down there at their landing field, at Firestone's landing field, where we all landed and spent the night. I stayed behind with the crew of the downed plane until such a time as a new engine could be flown into us and we could replace the damaged engine with a new engine. We were there about 10 days, and that's the first place I played golf, was in Liberia, West Africa. For a nickel a round, I could get a boy to watch my ball. I'd hire four of them because the golf balls were very hard to come by. So for 20 cents, I could hire four of them to keep track of my ball, and I didn't lose any. Firestone had the golf course there on their plantation for their white supervisors. They also had a bar there with American whiskey, which we hadn't seen any for quite some time. Needless to say, I think that's why we played golf, because you had to play nine holes before you could go to the bar. Anyway, we changed the engine, and then we completed our trip on up to Trinidad as a lone plane, landing in the Azores and again in Blim, Brazil, and then on up. Blim, Brazil was a very interesting place. We overnighted there, but they had a museum at the airport that showed all kinds of native and herbal medicines for everything you could think of, from stomach ache to earache to rheumatism and menstrual pains and cramps and anything you could think of. They had a natural remedy there on display. I've often wondered why some of the American medicine, instead of using chemicals, doesn't use some of the natural treatments that these people had developed for many years. We landed in Trinidad, and 2 days later, one of my buddies and I were transferred to Atkinson Field in British Guiana. You may remember that British Guiana is where this reverend and his some 600 followers committed suicide. But I was stationed there until August, when my orders came through to come back to the States, having over 200 points for discharge on the point system. I was anxious to get back home after having been married a few short days when I had to go back overseas. I landed in Miami, Florida on VJ Day, and everything was shut down. I could not celebrate. I stood at a telephone in line for something like 8 hours before I got worked up till it was my turn on the pay telephone to call my wife in Mitchell and tell her I was back in the States. I got a hold of her about 2 o'clock in the morning, and needless to say, she was excited. I told her I would give her a call when I had further orders and knew when I where I was going and where I would be and when. I then had to get on a troop train and go from Miami to Minneapolis up to Wool Chamberlain, where the Army Air Corps had a base there at Wool Chamberlain, which is now the big Minneapolis Air Base or Airport. From there, I was given a 30-day pass, and my wife came in on the train and met me there. We stayed in Minneapolis a couple of days, and we took the train back to Mitchell. Then from Mitchell, I went back to Minneapolis and reported in. My wife went with me. We stayed in a motel. I went out and reported to the air base the next morning, as I had been ordered. And I was told to prepare to leave at 11 o'clock on a troop train to head to Norfolk, Virginia, to take a boat back over to and I got discharged. So they gave me a 3-day pass. And I reported back to my wife for 6 weeks on 3-day passes, trying to get me to re-enlist in the Air Corps, as they needed experienced personnel, and my MOS was such that I was in high demand. I finally threatened to go to the over their head and to the adjutant general if they didn't give me a discharge. They sent me from Wool Chamberlain to Romulus Field, Michigan, right outside Detroit. I spent a week there on 3-day passes trying to get me to re-enlist. And finally, I said to the attorney general, or the adjutant general, is getting a call tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock if I am not given discharge. Next morning at 8 o'clock, I reported back again, and they gave me travel orders to go to Lincoln, Nebraska, and assured me I would be discharged at Lincoln. I did have to go through 2 sessions of why I should re-enlist at Lincoln, but I was discharged in 2 days, and we returned to Mitchell that night, being about a 4-hour drive, and I was driving my car at the time. So we were able to get home around 10 o'clock or 10:30 that night back into Mitchell. That kind of covers the overseas experiences and my history of my military career being what it is.
How did people react to your returning home?
Some people saw me and were very friendly. Other people did not acknowledge the fact that I was a returning veteran at all.
What was your community like after you returned?
It was a lot of the GIs that were in the service were coming back at that time. Jobs were scarce. I took a job 10 days after I arrived home. I took a job with Saucony Vacuum Oil Company in their warehouse as a warehouseman at $160 a month, which is less than half of what I was making as a master sergeant in the Army, which gave me thoughts at the time, hey, maybe I should have re-enlisted.
What was the easiest adjustment from military life to civilian life?
I did not find much of adjustment to it. Being married, I settled into married life. We lived with my parents or my wife's parents until such a time as we could find a place, an apartment of our own. And two parents helped us furnish with what the excess they had. and my wife and I started normal living. I had the job at Sokoni at that time. We had some other friends that had come back from military service. We buddied with I don't remember making any new friends with anybody that had grown up and stayed at home during the war. Our friends, our circle of friends was primarily my buddies from Carthage.